She wore a sunflower print dress and red flats. And she took me outside under the tree and taught me the box step there in the shade. And the sun poured down like gold that day. And when she dropped me off, she touched my chin, looked into my eyes and said, just gotta be yourself. That's what my mama said. Just gotta be yourself. That's what everybody wants. You just gotta be yourself.
Wakey, wakey.
It's time for an unbalanced breakfast with Matt and Catherine, a.k.a. Smart.
Hamburger, the cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
My boy says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
Do you like apples?
I don't drink juice.
How about you, Sad Burns? You want some of this milk?
Bless his highly nutritious microwaveable macaroni and cheese dinner that people sold it on sale. Amen.
They've got the hottest takes on the hottest stories and trends in food, nutrition, and fitness.
Come on! Bread makes you fat.
Bread makes you fat?
I haven't had a carb since 2004.
Calories, that's a gluten. Fat, that's a gluten.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
So protein combined with synthetic aminos, vitamins, and minerals. Everything the body needs.
I'm only eating foods with less than 30% calories from fat. It's 40%.
He read the squirrels were high in cholesterol.
We're about to find out what happens when a policy student and a science student interact.
And I also brought you some hydroponically grown goji berries with vegan barbecue sauce and some organic pumpkin chips.
Short answer, being vegan just makes you better than most people.
I happen to be a vegetarian.
You must have had vegetables fresher than that growing up on a farm, Greg.
Never trust a vegetarian.
Looks like meat back on the menu.
The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WMFO, Tufts University, or the Friedman School of Nutrition.
Yes. Who's hungry?
And the people did feast upon the lambs and sloths and carp and anchovies and orangutans and breakfast cereals and fruit bats.
And good morning. Welcome to an unbalanced breakfast with myself, Matt.
And I'm Catherine, also known as Smarf.
As the intro explained. So we are coming to you live from WMFO, Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org, Tufts Freeform Radio. And this is a brand new show for us. I've been doing this for a little while, not the specific show, but on the radio. And is this your first time?
Yeah, I am so not an expert. It's going to be fun.
All you need to do is talk. I have everything else going here, the board and everything else.
You should see me. I'm like wearing gloves. I'm not allowed to touch the board or anything. I'm sitting across the table.
So basically how the show works is we will be here for an hour every Saturday from 8 to 9, doing our show, talking about everything related to food, nutrition, and fitness, however tangential it may be. If you want to call in, join the conversation. Number here is 617-627-3800, and I will do my best not to hang up on you. You can also reach both of us on Twitter. I'm at Boxman37.
And I'm at Nutrition Wonk. It's a new one. If you follow me, I am also at Smarf Dose, but you should be able to find me at Nutrition Wonk at Nutrition Wonk.
Excellent. So do you have any followers yet? Or are you just like you're starting from the ground zero?
I have 12 followers. This is really exciting.
Amazing. Yeah. So yeah, definitely hit us up. And yeah, feel free to join in, ask any questions, whatever you would like to do. We'll probably break up the talk from time to time with some songs. Could be related to food, could be just whatever we want to hear. I think that gets all the disclaimers out of the way, all the stuff. So
great.
About a little bit quickly about who we are. So we're both students at the Friedman School of Nutrition, part of Tufts in Boston. However, as the intro says, we are not here to represent the school in any way. Anything that we say is our own opinion. And it may be informed about what we learn, but isn't any school doctrine.
Yeah.
So myself, I am a student in the Agriculture, Food, and Environment program.
And I'm a student in Biochemical Molecular Nutrition and Nutrition Epidemiology. So we discovered right before this that we've only had one class together. We're both essentially getting the same degree, but in two completely different things.
Yours sounds incredibly intimidating, your program.
Yeah, that's why I signed up for it. I was like, I want the scariest sounding degree.
I think it worked out. All right, so how are you doing this morning?
Oh, I'm fine. This is actually really early for me, so I'm really impressed with myself for waking up. But I did fuel with some coffee this morning. So, anyway, I see you brought some props with you today.
Yeah. Matt. So, let me start. So this topic, actually, I did not come up with the idea for this topic, and you know, we're gonna relate it. Don't worry, it's not gonna be Sports Illustrated related tangents every week, but we are gonna relate this to fitness and nutrition. But I'm sure you all know that the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition has come out for the year. And
I actually didn't know that until
of course not.
Not everybody knows when the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit comes out.
So, well, you may have heard because there's been a ton in the news. Obviously, Ronda Rousey, a lot of people know who she is, recently got her first loss in the UFC, but it was a big deal because she was going to be in the magazine. She was on the ESPN body issue previously list, and now she's in SI. And the other big deal is that Ashley Graham is on the cover. There's actually three different covers. So there's Ronda Rousey, Ashley Graham, and Haley Clausen, who I do not know. But anyway, do you want me to go ahead and just read the letters, editor? Or read the letters, wow. Editor's
yeah,
letter
so
and explain
key,
what's going on here?
The key, yeah, go ahead and explain it.
So there's three different covers, which you can obviously collect if you feel so inclined. And the reason is because they wanted to show off different perceptions and images of beauty. So this is from MJ Day, who is the Swimsuit Edition editor. And talking about beauty, she says, so how do you choose one? The logical answer would be pick the most beautiful one. But what defines beauty today? The truth is times have changed and one size does not fit all. Our position on beauty is well known. Healthy, curvy, vivacious, and bold. It's not a size. The three cover models, Haley Clausen, Ronda Rousey, and Ashley Graham, demonstrate that. And then later she goes on to write, Ashley is a sultry feminine masterpiece. I dare you not to stare at her. We met at a casting several years ago. And what is usually a 20-minute chat lasted an hour and a half. She was captivating, and I couldn't get enough. Ashley commands your attention in her photographs, fully confident, as every woman should be, of her sexiness. And
I think the key point here is that Ashley Graham is technically a plus-size model.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
why...
Yeah,
she says that in the letter.
Yeah, so that's why kind of there's a whole defense of... I mean, I don't want to say it's a defense, but there's a whole, like, let's celebrate different body types because she's a plus-size model. And she's one of the three cover models.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a big deal. And then, obviously, with something like this, people have a wide degree of reactions. Thankfully, in this day and age, most of it was positive. Of course, there was, as is always the case, unfortunately, some negative reaction, including Cheryl Teagues, who is a former SI model herself.
And it also called the first American supermodel, I learned.
That's right.
Cheryl Teagues.
Which
yeah.
I guess is controversial in that circle. I saw some headlines when I was Googling things the other day, prepping for this. But anyway, let's hear what good old Cheryl had to say. She went on, this was live from the red carpet on E! News, and she was asked a question about this cover.
Do you love the fact that we're actually stepping outside of our comfort zones of what we know is like the model figure, and we're actually using full-figured women and making that a thing now?
Actually, I don't like it that we're talking about full-figured women because it's glamorizing them, and your waist should be smaller than 35. You know,
you heard it.
That's what Dr. Oz said, and I'm sticking to it. No, I don't think it's healthy.
Right.
Her face is beautiful, beautiful. But I don't think it's healthy in the long run.
So, yeah, she pulled a waist size out there from Dr. Oz, of all people, who's...
Yeah. That's always funny.
Very distinguished in the nutrition field.
Doctor, yeah, we love Dr. Oz. Everybody loves Dr. Oz. Yep. Mm-hmm. So she basically says that you should have a 35-inch waist or less than a 35-inch waist. And E! News, right, reported that she actually does have a 30-inch waist.
Mm-hmm.
Which
yes.
I was shocked because that's pretty thin. I was sort of like, oh, man, she's super slim. You know, for someone being considered a plus size model.
That's another thing people say. Wait a minute, if she's considered plus size, I was like, that's
yeah,
a skewed thing. Anyway.
Yeah, to me, you're like, what? That is true, actually. If you were to go see your doctor, your dietitian, they would recommend that women have a waist size under 35 inches and men should have a waist size under 40 inches because once you get over that number, you're just at increased risk for different sort of cardiometabolic risk factors. But huge caveat, I mean, I don't think the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition is really the place where people are concerned about how healthy these women are, especially when you think about early supermodels and how, you know, incredibly thin they were. and how that's probably not a healthy body type mm-hmm. either. You know, and the idea that, like, the whole idea that we're somehow expanding and becoming more open-minded by putting a plus-size woman on the cover of Sports Illustrated Swimsuit instead of saying, hey, swimsuit edition is not about sports. Like, why? I don't understand how this is progressive in any way, but I think that's kind of a larger issue.
It's a really weird thing. Somebody said, I forget what the comment was, but about, like, congratulations. This is for, you're mad about a magazine for middle-aged old men to read when they go take
a
dump.
Oh, dear.
You know, yeah. It's like, this is what sports are. I mean, it's probably just to keep their subscriptions in this right. day and age. So, Ashley has a quote, actually, in the magazine. So, I'll go through real quick. She says, scariest thing I've ever done in my life, giving a TED Talk in front of 400 people. It was called Plus Size, More Like My Size, and it was about my journey of loving my body. I have cellulite, I have rolls, I have all the things you're struggling with right now. I was told I'd never be an editorial model. I have proven everyone wrong who told me no. So.
Well, that's nice. That's mm-hmm. good. I mean, it's definitely good that people are more accepting of different body types. And I know that I have noticed on different sort of different places that I like to shop online, they'll actually feature people of all different sizes. And I think even more so than Ashley Graham, who has a very beautiful figure, you know, despite being larger than your average model. I think I've seen places like ModCloth, for instance, they have women who are all shapes and sizes. I think we're kind of expanding in editorial modeling to having, oh, this woman is bigger, but she still has the same sort of figure. And I think in more commercial modeling, you see people who actually have different body shapes, which mm-hmm. I think is positive.
Mm-hmm. And they are, like, you see, right from, as soon as you open the magazine, there's like a full page spread. Mm-hmm. And they are clearly integrating advertising, more diverse advertising there.
Right.
Although I did want to say, too, like, again, talking about how progressive exactly is this. This may be, again, looking too much into it, but take it for what it's worth. I decided to do a quick count off the top of my head when I was flipping through this magazine. And even though, obviously, it's considered an honor to be on the cover, she's not even the most photographed model in here. Neither is Ronda Rousey. They both have 4 pictures in here, which is the same amount as Chrissy Teigen and Gigi Haddad, and fewer than Hannah Davis and Irina. There's no way I pronounce her last name, but she is a kind of regular for the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition. So models from the past being more heavily featured than their current cover models, I just thought was interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know really anything about the way Sports Illustrated does them, except for I remember being, like, in elementary school, and they had the body paint come out, and, like, as a little kid being like, this is the, like, naughtiest thing ever to see. And that's about as much as I know about Sports Illustrated. I mean, to me, it's sort of like, yeah, exactly, like, at what point, like, how progressive can you really be with putting a bunch of women in bikinis and taking photos of them, and then somehow saying it's sports? I don't know. And I think that's a debate that comes up every year, and I'm sure there are people much more articulate than I am who express opinions about this really well. But mm-hmm. didn't Cheryl Teagues kind of issue a follow-up on this?
Yeah, she tweeted out, you know, classic celebrity attempts at damage control is never a good thing. Well, this probably could be worse, but she tweeted out, to clarify, RE body weight, being anorexic / bulimic / overweight, all connected to health problems. I want all to be as healthy as they can, which also received the inevitable negative backlash, where celebrities should probably just stay off Twitter.
Yeah, and I mean, not to sort of categorize this even more, but you know, Cheryl Teagues is of a different generation. Mm-hmm. I think it makes a lot of sense that people who are older might have that more kind of traditional idea of, like, this is what's healthy. And I think that people who are growing up through the 90s and through more and more people becoming overweight, sort of realizing, like, a lot of people live their lives at different sizes, and that's okay, and you're accustomed to it, you're used to it. And I think that it's definitely important that Cheryl Teagues not be okay that she said that, but I think that it's definitely it's an opinion that's out there, and so it's good to be aware of it so that we can kind of shut it down.
Mm-hmm. And then before, because I know that you want to talk about some of the signs behind mm-hmm. this, I just want to interject too, since we're on the topic of sports and weight, is another local news item that came up this week was Pablo Sandoval of your Boston Red Sox, not my Boston Red Sox. Could not hate that team anymore. But anyway, it's always fun because for the past 5 years, it's been hilarious to follow this team because they're just such a mess. So Pablo Sandoval, their big free agent acquisition from 2 seasons ago, showed up to spring training, and there were a couple photos posted online of him where his shirt was riding up. And people lost their minds over his gut spilling out over his shorts down in Florida. And then in follow-up interviews, his apparent lack of caring about quote-unquote getting in shape, especially last year after a last place finish and a down year for him statistically his worst season ever. And then there's a huge argument about whether the team had asked him to lose weight or not, whether it matters. The team is trying to do damage control. And then an old San Francisco, no, I shouldn't say old, but a, I believe he's still a current announcer for the San Francisco Giants, Pablo's former team, did an interview and said, yes, Pablo has an eating disorder, which raised a lot of red flags because obviously, you know, eating disorders aren't synonymous with just bulimia and anorexia. There are a whole ton of different conditions that are very serious, mm-hmm. whether it be, you know, if it's like, so it could be binge self-harm, could be, yes, mm-hmm. all sorts of things. So it's not a term you can just throw out there lightly. I don't think there's been any follow-up, so nobody actually knows whether he has a true eating disorder or if he was just kind of saying, like, yeah, the guy just can't control himself, just likes to eat a ton. So anyway, I just thought it was interesting, too, because in sports, obviously you don't hear this a lot with males, whereas females outside of Sports Illustrated, I mean, even going back to Serena Williams recently quoted about body image and what the female athlete is supposed to look like. And you don't hear the backlash from males. And, you know, if this is a baseball player, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you don't need to be in shape to play baseball. But then other people say, like, that may be true. I know Babe Ruth, not exactly the most fit guy.
Yeah, that's what I always think of.
It all, I mean, Pablo's going to be, he's 29 right now. And it's going to get to a point where that all catches up to you. There's been other players, CeCe Sabathia, who was overweight. People say, oh, no, that's what he needs to be good. And then it turns out, oh, he starts to break down and get injured. He's an alcoholic. So there's all sorts of other problems going on with him, too.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a thing. Like, should, as a role model, does a male athlete, too, have responsibility to look a certain way? Live a certain lifestyle? Like, yeah. I don't know. It's,
you know, I don't know, because I don't really follow a lot of sports. So I think that people who are really big fans might have a better idea of this. But I would think that, you know, your performance is key. And the way that you look is not important at all. And for me, it was funny because you brought this up to me. And I was like, isn't baseball the one where they're, like, kind of allowed to be a little chubby? Like, I feel like chubby baseball players is a thing. But I could be thinking of, like, yeah, I could be thinking of just, like, super old school, like, Babe Ruth baseball players. But, yeah, I mean, I think that it's not fair. I think that, like, yeah, the Williams sisters get a lot of heat for that type of thing, and it's definitely something that affects women a lot. But crossing over and affecting men, too, is also not a good thing, I think. But I don't know. Is it something that affects performance or affecting his performance?
It's, you know, like all good things in science and nutrition, is there, what's the correlation versus causation? A lot of people said, hey, he showed up to San Francisco 1 year in 2010 in the quote-unquote best shape of his life, which everyone says in spring training, and he had, before coming to Boston, his worst season ever, and so they're like, oh, well, he needs that weight. People said that about CeCe Sabathia. When he lost weight, he showed up and was a terrible pitcher, and there's been other players, but again, it's like, well, you know, is that because they need to be heavy, or is it because they're comfortable psychologically? Some people say, no, if Pablo is like a head case, if he's challenged, if he's being asked questions about his weight and is being, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether or not a team can or should have a weight clause in their contracts for their players. Like, is, you know, if the team's after him, is he, you know, kind of feeling depressed about that, and that's like a distraction, and that's why he's bad and not hitting well. Like, yeah, there's all sorts of stuff that goes into it.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that if you are constantly monitoring your intake and you're a professional athlete, that the pressure of both of those things would make you drop at least one ball. And that pun was so not intended. You know, and I think that, yeah, if your performance is good, that should be what your sports team is worried about, right? I mean, there are other sports where your weight does matter, I guess, like rowing. Or like sumo wrestling, both of those probably have weight requirements.
Yeah, well, there's two, because it's like, it's a cultural thing, because I'm a big professional wrestling fan, and Samoans have a huge cultural, it's a huge part of that professional wrestling and football too, especially the, this is kind of a goofy thing, but like just the Hawaiian football, college football team is known, like they have a lot of Samoans playing on there, and they're, it's like a cultural thing, like a lot of those guys are pretty big, and, you know, again, you can, there's so many different things to consider and what's acceptable and what's not. One thing I will say, too, just a caveat for if you're a baseball player and you're making about $18 million a year, as Pablo is, should it be your responsibility to invest in a personal chef? And that way you don't have to worry about.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think, too, there's something to be said for it's important for people to realize that, like, your weight can affect your health. It people can be overweight and be healthy. That does happen for sure, but it can affect your health. And so if that's something that concerns you, you know, you should definitely do something about it. But should your job be able to require you to do something about it, especially if you're a professional athlete? I mean, that's something I definitely don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm sure people have very strong opinions about it.
Yep. Those have been flying around this week. So
yeah.
So yeah, do you want to bring some science into this? And I know that you, there was one article that you wrote, right, in the Tufts Nutrition magazine this month that touches a little bit on weight and health. And then I know there's another study you wanted to talk about.
Yeah. So, I guess there's definitely, I wrote a couple. One was on obesity and colorectal cancer, which is probably a little less interesting. But one thing I wanted to kind of bring up was a couple different things that kind of are what we were a little bit related to what we were talking about before, which is that talking about waist circumference. So we talked about how Cheryl Teague says Dr. Oz told her that your waist circumference needs to be less than 35. That is the kind of ideal cutoff for a woman in terms of when your waist size starts to be associated with risks. That doesn't mean that you have those risks, right? Like, people are all different sizes. But there are a couple different ways of measuring it. And one is BMI, which a lot of people have probably heard of. And if you have a BMI over 30, you're considered to be obese. And there was recently an article in PLOS One, which is a scientific journal, that kind of compared your BMI to your waist circumference to something called your waist to height ratio, which I had actually never heard of it being used as a metric. And they wanted to see, like, people will argue, like, waist circumference is better for assessing whether or not someone has a risk factor, or BMI is better, or they're both awful. And basically what they concluded was that all of those things are equally good in terms of they're equally associated with adverse outcomes. And so they're equally good as sort of benchmarks when you go to your doctor, you see a nutritionist. But at the same time, they're not particularly precise. So what Cheryl Teague doesn't get completely right is that you can't look at somebody and measure their waist and know their health outcomes. And I think also you can't look at somebody in a bathing suit on Sports Illustrated and know whether or not that person is healthy. So it's important to know that, like, your doctor's doing that to get an idea and to kind of give you a benchmark of where you are. But that doesn't mean that you could look at someone and know whether or not they're healthy. And then the other thing, actually, is that the CDC has just determined that the prevalence of obesity in United States adults has finally gone over 30%. So we're hanging out at like 29.8% obese in the United States, but we have finally hit about 30%. And in people ages 40 to 59, it's about 34%. So people between 40 and 59, 1 in 3 of those people are not just overweight, they're obese.
This off the top of my head, I thought recently too that in younger people that finally started to plateau. I don't know if that was true or not.
In adolescence, I think that they've seen that there's been a plateau in adolescence, and I think maybe a slowing of obesity in really young children. I'd have to double check the citations on that. So all of that is really good. And the CDC, at the same time, they kind of released the bad news and the good news. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they said that, like, more American adults now than ever are meeting the exercise requirements. So, and about 50% of adults are reporting that they're meeting the cardio requirements. So whether or not
you've... Self-reported, right?
I mean, I actually don't know if it's self-reported. I would imagine it's self-reported, yes. But they're saying that they're meeting the cardio requirements. So either they know what they are and they're saying, yeah, I think I get about that much. Mm-hmm. But still, that's probably it represents a real improvement. However, you know, take heart, because if you are dealing with obesity or high BMI, recent research that just came out in Cell Metabolism showed that just losing 5% of your body weight confers most of the weight loss benefits in terms of health outcomes. So the greatest reduction in risk for diabetes and other, you know, chronic disease risks, they go down when you lose that first 5%. So you don't need to worry about, like, you don't need to be Swimsuit Illustrated model size to lower your risk factors. So that's some good news.
Definitely. And so for those benchmarks you talked about, do you have to, like, especially... If you're curious about this, you need to specially request that from your doc. I mean, I'm sure they're all different, but, like, I know that if I go for a physical, like, they take my height and weight and then don't say anything, so.
Yeah, they'll usually take your height and weight, and I know there's some stuff on whether or not doctors really bring up overweight with patients, and that if doctors themselves are overweight, they might be less likely to bring up overweight with patients because you're just so used to seeing people who are overweight. It doesn't necessarily seem like something you need to or should bring up. And so everybody deals with that differently. But yeah, if you go see your doctor, they're going to take your height and weight. And if you are dealing with like some serious overweight issues, it's definitely something your doctor should bring up. I've never been to the doctor and had them measure my waist. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's something that's standard practice for doctors. I know for dietitians, when you do an initial assessment, you can do a number of different measurements. So what they'll basically do is they'll either calculate your BMI, they'll take your height and weight and calculate your BMI. They can do a waist circumference. You can also do, you could do like body fat impedance, like a DEXA scan, depending on kind of how fancy the place that you're going to is. And they can tell you your body fat percentage. So if you're interested in that, all of those things are available, but I don't think they're all part of like your standard,
right,
your checkup. Yeah.
All right. So, well, that's a lot of stuff to open up the first show. Mm-hmm. So, if you want to weigh in at all, number here is 617-627-3800. We're also both on Twitter, Boxman37, and I'm sorry, I forget your
at
new one.
Nutrition Wonk.
Nutrition Wonk.
W-O-N-K. It sounds like policy, but it's
that,
not.
I like it.
Not policy.
All right. So then when, we're going to play a song or two here, and then when we come back, we're going to, a little bit, some very different topics. We're going to talk a little bit about SNAP, some upcoming changes and challenges, some good news on the whole, right, about coffee, and then have some fun later on with the presidential candidates. It's Super Tuesday coming up here in Massachusetts and a bunch of other places, so we're going to talk about presidents and food. First, we're going to play... So, for those who don't know, I came from... I was doing a metal show for the past year and a half here on WMFO, so this is very different, but still going to fit in some... music that borders on the metal genre. So here's the new one from the Deftones. This is Prayers/Triangles off their upcoming album Gore. You're listening to An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org in Medford. There's
This message is for all of you sitting in the passenger seat. And apologies if it gets a little uncomfortable. But how does it feel to be at the mercy of someone who thinks a random text is more important than your life? Someone who takes their eyes off the road while speeding along in a 3-ton hunk of steel. Freaky, right? Well, why not just ask them to stop? Or better yet, volunteer to text for them. It might be a little awkward, but believe me, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
Welcome back to An Unbalanced Breakfast with Matt and Catherine, a.k.a. Smarf.
Hello.
You're listening to WMFO in Medford, 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. Again, here, if you want to call in for the second half of the show, number here is 617-627-3800. You can also reach us on Twitter at Boxman37 or Nutrition Wonk.
Yes.
Did I get that right?
Yeah, you did.
Excellent.
Yes.
So, we mentioned that we were going to talk about coffee.
Yeah.
One item of news, which is great for people who drink, maybe, drink alcohol. And then another piece that you wanted to touch on.
Yeah. So funny, kind of funny story, though, this morning when I was meeting Matt before the show, he texted and he was like, oh, do you want some coffee? I'm holding a cup of takeout coffee. And I literally thought, yes, I do want more coffee. And I had to stop myself from being like, yes, could you please bring me some more coffee? It's a very popular beverage. I don't know. Both of us drink it, right? Neither of us are coffee abstainers.
Yep. Yeah. 64% of Americans apparently drink at least one cup a day.
Yeah. So what's the good news?
Oh, so if you want to do that first, that there's a study, I believe it's a systematic review, that it says that, I believe it's 2 cups of coffee a day can decrease your risk of cirrhosis.
Hmm.
So, of course, anything like that, you need to consider all the different things that can go into this.
Like you're taking a break from alcohol twice a day to have a couple cups
exactly,
of coffee.
Exactly, yeah. So this does not mean to just go out and have... Oh, I can drink 6 beers and have 6 coffees and I'll be fine. No, that's not exactly what's going to happen.
Did they say why they thought that was an effect?
I would have to go back and check the specific details.
Yeah.
But it was just, with the studies that they looked at, you can reduce your chances of developing the disease by 44%.
Mm.
They looked at 9 studies, which covered over 400,000 individuals. So promising, and that's definitely good news, I would say.
Right.
But, I wouldn't, rush out and think that you can be invincible.
Right.
There's not a magic bullet, as I like to say, in nutrition. Yeah.
And it's kind of similar to the alcohol benefits where people ask, like, oh, should I start drinking if I don't drink now? Because they recommend, mm-hmm. one alcoholic beverage a day. And, of course, doctors are like, no, definitely don't start. There might be some health benefits conferred, but that's different than it being a health, quote-unquote, health food.
Mm-hmm.
Coffee will never be kale, unfortunately. But yeah, so I found something on there was recently a post on the New York Times Well blog, and it was by someone who was wondering, well, I don't drink coffee now, should I really start drinking coffee? And that was kind of the advice that he was getting. It was, we know that it's not bad for you. It's linked to some health effects, but it's not really the same thing as being a health food. If you don't currently drink it, you're not necessarily missing out on things.
Mm-hmm.
But they definitely talked about how drinking coffee is linked with better cognitive function, and better short-term memory and that type of thing, which I 100% believe. But I think also they point out that a lot of people are addicted to coffee and caffeine, and so without those, without coffee, they're functioning lower. Maybe not necessarily because they've had coffee, but because they haven't had caffeine yet.
So do you think? Now I feel dumb because I forgot to check the actual dietary guidelines. But when the advisory report came out, it mentioned that it was up to 5 cups
mm-hmm.
is good and could have and is associated with health benefits such as reduced risk of heart disease and type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a question I always have. Obviously, dietary guidelines very controversial, but mm-hmm. like it's one of those things. If the dietary guidelines come out saying, "Oh yeah, coffee is good,"
yeah.
or the advisory committee report says that, and then you have something here in New York Times like, "Oh, should I start? Should I stop?" Like,
right.
I don't know. What do you think about that? If the government is implying that there's benefits here?
Yeah. I mean, what the dietary guidelines has to do is they have to take a certain level of evidence. So there's a bunch of different, systematic reviews and meta-analyses that they have to look at to kind of determine what's good. And a lot of times they're looking at reports from the IOM, the Institute of Medicine, and they're kind of formulating what evidence exists and making recommendations based off of that. So that's why, there used to be this whole big controversy because they said, the IOM said that like up to, 25% of your calories could be from added sugar. Don't quote me on that number because that's probably wrong. And people were really offended by that. But the problem wasn't that they necessarily said, well, this is definitely true. It was just the level of evidence that they had at that point. So I think that's a little bit more what they were, I could be wrong, and I'll definitely ask around about that, but I think that's probably more what they say when they say up to 5 cups a day, you don't really see any downsides,
right.
And you see some benefits. But it's not like they've added a cup of coffee to the Eat Right plate, right?
Right.
Like there's like another...
You milk and your
yeah,
coffee.
You've got like your 3 servings of milk and your 5 cups of coffee. So I would think that they're basically, because they also talk about alcohol in the DGAC. They kind of try and mm-hmm. mention everything.
Yeah. And the guidelines have been out for a while now. People have talked about that forever, so we're not going to get into that. But it is, it's one of those things too where it's unfortunate because there is a lot of good science that goes into the dietary guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people just kind of write it off, whether it be because of connections to big ag and the meat
right.
sustainability issues. So it's
right.
not like you should just completely ignore the guidelines.
Right.
Obviously, not necessarily supposed to follow them to a T either. In conclusion, as always, it's mostly about personal choice. And as long as if it works for you in a positive way without overdoing it, everything in moderation, you might say, then it's good. We are not here to tell you to follow any specific sort
of diet. Definitely not. And it is one thing, though, to note that the report of the advisory committee is not the same thing as the dietary guidelines. So the advisory committee report is when they kind of pull together a bunch of scientists, several from Tufts actually, and they have them kind of create, based on the literature, what they think the guidelines should be. And then it has to go through Congress, and then that's when people, you know, get worried that lobbies get involved and things like that. And then from that point, that's when it becomes the dietary guidelines. So there are definitely changes that get made between the advisory committee and the dietary guidelines.
Yep. It's a huge involved process. It is pretty interesting, even if you don't aren't into science and all that. And it got pretty heated this year with the sustainability, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's going to be back in 5 years again. So we'll see where it goes. Speaking of lobbying, actually, I forgot to mention this one. GMO stuff is also back in the news. And we're not going to go into a huge debate, but it's interesting to note that, in case you're not aware, so Vermont, a while back passed the first, mandatory GMO labeling law, which is set to go in effect on July 1st. Of course, that means it's coming down to the wire for people who are anti-GMO labeling to, get some legislation passed to overrule that. So Pat Roberts has had a hell of a week. He's the chairman of the Senate Ag Committee. Republican senator from Kansas, and I have to bring this up. This guy goes on, decides it's a good idea. This is not related to nutrition, but I thought it was indicative of, I guess, well, I won't get too into politics now, but of that line of thinking where he posted a Twitter video of himself saying, "This is what I think about the president's order to close Gitmo," crumples it up. And then there's like a slow motion thing of him throwing it in the trash. So real hardo there.
But, that's sort of like snowball on the Congress floor. Yeah.
And then jokes on him, because then this week they were supposed to vote on the Senate version of the, so House, mostly pushed by Republicans and industry, does not want to have to label GMOs. So they're trying to pass a nationwide law that would preempt any states passing mandatory laws. It would make GMO labeling voluntary only. Of course, that means nobody would do it. So the House passed their version last year. Senate version ran into, I guess he did not have the support that he thought he was going to have initially. There's all sorts of other stuff obviously going on in the Senate. So they had to push that vote off to this week.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition, so again, that's going to say whether or not we'll see if Vermont's law actually goes through on July 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Connecticut and Maine also passed GMO labeling laws, but theirs are kind of weird because they don't go into effect until other people enact it.
Oh, really?
I guess they need to strengthen numbers.
Okay.
Maine's is,
like,
I believe,
a certain number of states or something?
Yeah, so Maine, which interestingly enough, that bill was signed off on by Governor LePage, who just endorsed Donald Trump.
Hmm.
But at the time, he signed through that bill with no problem, but he cited the vast public support for GMO labeling.
Right.
But Maine's doesn't go into effect until five other states pass laws,
mm-hmm.
and Connecticut's doesn't go into effect until any combination of northeastern states with a combined population of 20 million people goes into effect. So,
that's interesting.
Yeah,
I wonder if it's just they consider it to be such a burden, maybe on the food suppliers. They just don't have enough people. Like, they'll just lose food supply rather than actually get them to label Maine.
Yeah, bring up the cost. So, a study came out, of course, notably funded by the Corn Refiners Association. And their big splashy headline was that, it's going to cost families $1,000 per year if this happens. to clarify, this would be a line of logic following that if they redid the entire food supply to take GMOs out, it could cost families $1,000 a year. The cost to label that they came up with was a one-time cost of $30 per family.
Yeah.
So even that is not a huge hit.
Yeah.
And so I think, yeah. And it's interesting to note that the food industry. So this is another part of the debate about. And again, we're gonna only spend another minute on this, but for GMO labeling, the food industry estimates that 75% or 75 to 80% of all food contains some sort of GMO.
Really?
So it would be again.
So it's probably soy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Most of it, and then so it's one of those things like if people see these GMO labels on
they're
going to
be afraid of their breakfast cereal, you know? I mean, I think the only issue I see with GMO labeling, like if people really, really want something, like they want like nutrition labels to change. I think, you know, we live in a democracy. That should be something you can make happen. But GMOs are things people don't really understand what they are. It's kind of like labeling food and saying, like, this food contains ghosts, or like this food contains alien particles. Like, you don't know. What does that mean? Like, some people really think that if they eat a GMO, the genes from that GMO can get into their body and change their genes. Like, that, no, that can't happen. And so I think the problem is that, like, a lot of the push to label GMOs comes from not really understanding what a GMO is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so with voluntary labeling, then in theory, you could have companies, you know, they pay to get the certification that says they aren't GMO.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are really concerned about it. And then for the most part, and I could be wrong, but for the most part in the United States, most of the GMO crops are soy and grains. Soy and wheat, right? Or not wheat.
Not wheat.
Soy and what's the other one? Yeah. So it's really just that there are like two staple crops. You can basically look up what are the crops in the U.S. that are
corn.
And that was, sorry, thank you. Soy and corn. I don't know why I forgot.
That's pathetic.
Corn.
AFE student.
Yeah.
Drawing a blank here.
Yeah.
First show.
So soy and corn, you know, if you're really worried about GMOs, make sure, you know, look for those things.
Salmon, soon to be.
Oh, and salmon. Well, we'll see if how far they get with that. But yeah, that's really interesting. But yeah, so GMO labeling, it's a whole big crazy. Crazy
yeah,
world.
Yeah, plenty of stuff on that. That's an interesting note, of course, the Vermont connection. Bernie Sanders is very pro, again, citing the power of the people, pro GMO labeling. So that's another interesting factor.
Yeah.
At this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then, so the other big thing, a lot of going on with SNAP right now. So, of course, that has to do with food assistance. For those of you who don't know, Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program, and basically people can apply if they're at a certain income level.
Mm-hmm.
A whole bunch of different factors go into it. I was on food stamps actually for a year through AmeriCorps, so
I was on them for a month actually through AmeriCorps.
Oh really?
And then they got taken away.
Why did they get taken away for you? Because this could be an interesting.
So what happened is I applied and I was I was doing AmeriCorps, and basically I don't know if everybody understands, but like when you do AmeriCorps, you're on a stipend, you're not on a salary, and usually that stipend is far below the poverty line, even for a single person. And so part of the way that they kind of supplement you is that you qualify for SNAP. So I qualified for SNAP. I got, you know, a SNAP for a month. And then they basically told me that they hadn't gotten one of the documents that they needed, which was untrue. I had sent it, but, you know, I resent it and everything. And they never like reinstated it. And I called, but they were always very busy,
mm-hmm.
you know. So basically when you apply for SNAP, they assign you a caseworker, they take all of your information, and then you get approved or you don't. And the problem is that, you know, there's no electronic way, at least in Massachusetts, to reach your caseworker. There's no way to email and explain anything.
My assigned caseworker had retired a year earlier.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, exactly. What? I'm trying to find this person and they are impossible to find. Mm-hmm. It's incredible.
What state, where was that?
I was here, yeah.
Oh, you were in Massachusetts?
I was in Massachusetts.
Which is interesting because Massachusetts relatively, I mean, probably not surprising, but kind of knows the deal, especially with AmeriCorps. So like I submitted my package and I mean it took a little while to finally get it approved or whatever and okayed, but I got my retroactive benefits and stuff like that. I got the full amount, and
mm-hmm.
maybe it's because I was Vista and they just know how Vista works,
I think. Yeah,
but so yeah, that's interesting that you actually ran into trouble in Massachusetts. And but I mean, going through the process, I mean, we're fortunate that it's not, we don't have to rely on it
right.
for most of our
sure.
lives. But I mean,
yeah.
even the fact that we study some of this stuff and the process is kind of
archaic difficult.
For us. And then you can imagine for people, whether English isn't their first language or different socioeconomic statuses.
I know. I think people think that you just show up at like some welfare office with like cushy couches and you just stand in line and then they like are like, here's your $200 for the month. Like, mm-hmm. no,
yeah.
that is not what happens at all.
It is not fun.
Yeah.
So real quick, some of the stuff in the news. I think there's four different things going on, maybe three. We'll see. So first, there's a push for changing retail eligibility. So there's different ways that people want to improve the SNAP program in terms of the food consumed by SNAP recipients. So the most common one and most controversial one is probably restricting what you can buy with SNAP benefits. You can buy a whole ton of, very little is restricted right now, prepared/hot foods you can't buy, and a couple of food you're going to eat in the store or whatever you can't buy, but most anything else that's food you can buy, including which people do, you can't buy alcohol. But you can buy soda, ice cream, junk food, all that stuff, which some people don't like. In fact, in New York State, they just introduced another bill to try to restrict purchases. That hasn't gone anywhere yet. I know different states have tried to do pilot programs. The USDA has said no. So this is just another attempt specifically to New York. So we'll see if that actually goes anywhere. I doubt it. But that's one thing that's always going on. And then in terms of retailers, people want to restrict it at a different level and saying, hey, if you're going to be able to accept SNAP, which it's pretty important for certain retailers in certain locations, that you need to kind of change up your inventory. So there is a bill right now, which you can actually read about in the upcoming issue of the Sprout, the Friedman Sprout. But changes are going to be requiring what types of food are stocked in terms of staple foods. So there's different categories of food, so you have to have more in the categories. The law's a little dense to read, so definitely check out the article when it's published because it will be broken down very nicely.
And that'll be on the 1st.
The 1st of March. We should mention that we're co-editors of Friedman Sprout, but this show has nothing to do with the Friedman Sprout. No. It's a completely separate, independent project.
Yeah.
And so that's another thing to look for. And then another big thing is that coming up, I believe, at the end of this month, what had happened was, there was some reform and they required employment, showing that you have to be employed to get SNAP benefits.
Right.
That was back, I believe... I'm going to get all the history of it confused. I believe it was a reform under the Clinton administration.
Okay.
And then with the recession, that
so
was
a long time
done
ago.
Away with. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it's saying like people can't find, they shouldn't worry about finding jobs.
No.
They need to eat. So
right.
You don't need that requirement. And then that's going to expire in 22 states across the country very soon, which is going to affect, I feel like it should be more, but at least 500,000 people who will no longer be able to get SNAP benefits if they can't find a job within 3 months.
Wow.
So, talking about the process just to apply for SNAP is pretty hard. Shout out to another former local DJ, Detention, actually published something in the Weekly Dig this week about trying to apply for unemployment and how ridiculous that is, again, even in a state in Massachusetts. So if it's somebody who's experienced here is having problems in one of the more progressive blue states, as they say, and then that's going to be compounded by SNAP and all these other...
What's the reason for that? Because I always think you would think that if you aren't employed, that would be like, you would be high priority for SNAP. What's the reasoning behind not letting somebody get SNAP dollars if they aren't working?
Honestly, I don't know the original, why it was tacked on originally. Okay. I've read opinions that it has to do with like the whole myth of, you know, welfare fraud and all that stuff.
Yeah, because SNAP dollars is so much money.
Right.
It doesn't even pay for like one person's groceries.
Yeah, exactly. And now I'm sure a lot of states aren't going to... more than willing to let it expire.
Yeah.
So, anything else in the news you wanted to talk about before we do a real quick thing on presidential candidates?
Oh, yeah. Well, just a complete segue. I know that probably you and I and everyone have become obsessed with taking photos of our food when we go to restaurants and then posting it online. And actually, a recent study in the Journal of Consumer Marketing wanted to see if taking photos of your food and using, you know, Instagram filters and things would affect how you felt about the food. And so apparently when you take a picture of your food, you take that moment to like look at it and kind of savor it. And if you know anything about the idea of kind of intuitive eating or mindful eating, that's something that they really encourage you to do, like smell your food, experience your food. And so apparently, you know, taking a picture of your food is kind of a similar thing. So it gives you this moment of sort of like savoring the moment before you eat and increasing the anticipation. So I thought that was interesting. I would think it was like, well, now your food's cold.
Right.
Because you spent so much time trying to get the right lighting.
There you go. Power of social media.
Yeah, exactly. So you're doing a good thing for yourself. Don't feel bad, hipsters.
Except your almond milk, right, Tom?
Oh,
So we're going to conclude there with a fun thing about presidential candidates. Obviously, we mentioned Super Tuesday coming up. In the debates, very little has been spoken about food policy. So Huffington Post, regardless of how you may feel about them, there's an article by Eve Turo-Paul, and she did a great job going back and aggregating everything she could find about what every candidate at that time thought about food policy. So interesting to see here. Again, this is according to what she dug up. But
And I don't know any of this.
Yeah,
right?
So we're going to see if Catherine can name the candidate. I mean, some of these, you're going to guess the party at least right away. But So first, this candidate plans to double funding for the Farmers Market Promotion Program and the local food promotion programs to support SNAP recipients' access to fresh food. Who do you believe that is?
So it's a Democrat. I'll guess Bernie.
That is incorrect. That is Hillary
Clinton.
Yep.
Awesome.
So, yeah, she's also tweeted out, what happens to kids and families cut from unemployment insurance and food stamps? They're too, hashtag, too small to fail and deserve an equal chance to succeed.
I agree with that.
Mm-hmm. let's stick with food stamps.
Okay.
So this person once wrote, the food stamp program was originally created as temporary assistance for families with momentary times of need, and it shouldn't be needed often. Thankfully, 96% of America's poor parents say their children never suffer even a day of hunger. But when half of food stamp recipients have been on the dole for nearly a decade, something is clearly wrong, and some of it has to do with fraud.
Okay, so dole and fraud make me think it's a Republican. And some of it has to, and it's pretty articulate. I don't know, like Marco Rubio.
Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's surprising.
Yep.
Maybe it's just said it and it sounded smarter.
I love how, too, like, so each of these are broken down by categories, and a lot of his is no public comment available because... Not surprisingly,
because
hasn't
he
really...
was, other than like, you're fired.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
should be able to just insert that for his opinion on anything else.
So let's see. This one was actually, I guess, in a recent debate. This candidate said, the best policy is to get rid of all government subsidies and get the government out of our lives and let people rise and fall based on how good they are. He claims he would phase out agricultural subsidies over 10 years.
Ayn Rand said that, I'm pretty sure. I think it... will be, so he wants to phase out government, I don't know, Ted Cruz. Now I'm just saying names.
Ben Carson. So, but you won't need to worry about him and his food policy.
Yeah.
So going back.
Although he does support fruit salad, I heard.
That He's is true, yeah, that was a, no, oh, yeah. Did not watch that, but, And here's another thing about subsidies. So on this person's website, it says it is unacceptable that the top 10% of farms collect 75% of farm subsidies while the bottom 62%...
Bernie Sanders.
No, okay, there you go. That's a process of elimination. You didn't even need to do that. Two more for you.
All right.
This is an old one. I guess this is this person's stance from 20 years ago, but could still be the same. Says that at the time, this person co-sponsored a welfare reform bill that for the first time ever put a time limit on recipients' access to food stamps. Healthy, childless adults would be able to receive SNAP benefits for no more than 3 months in any three-year period unless they were employed or in a training program for at least 20 hours a week, which is very timely.
So I wonder
His
if this
state
would be...
was ranked by the USDA among the worst states for food security.
Oh, gosh. And this is a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And his state was the worst for food security. Well, okay, so I would guess this is during the Clinton administration, right? From what you were talking about earlier?
Yep.
So would this have been, well, now I'm not going to, is this, could this be Jeb Bush?
John Kasich. Or Kasich, however you want to say that. But yeah, so.
What's his state? Now I'm really
Ohio.
Embarrassed.
Yeah, Ohio. Like where I almost went for AmeriCorps, by the way, but.
Where, oh, really?
Did not, yeah.
Oh, man.
All right, so there you go. There's a quick primer for you on if you're basing your Super Tuesday vote on solely on food policy. There's some stuff to go by. So we are pretty much out of time here, so we're gonna wrap things up for this week. Any last words that you want to say?
No, you know, enjoy your breakfast. As the intro said, hamburger is an essential part of breakfast.
Yeah, that was a Pulp Fiction quote.
Yeah, I like the Monty Python you threw.
Yeah, yeah.
Too.
Wrapping up with that.
Yes.
All right, excellent. So, yeah, we'll be posting. Maybe we'll get some sort of website, web presence online. I know that you have. We'll be launching something that people
yes,
can look out for.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully next week I'll be able to tell you about that.
Yep. So, in the meantime, we will be back same time, same place next week.
Yeah.
Here, you've been listening to the inaugural edition of An Unbalanced Breakfast with Matt and Catherine. And until next Saturday, everybody... have a great week.
Yeah, and don't stop drinking coffee if you're drinking coffee.
Keep it going.
Yeah.
All right. We'll see you later. Salt and laughter too. A scoop of kids to add the spice. A dash of love to make it nice. And you've got too many cooks. Too many cooks. Too many cooks.